Critical Readings, a podcast of literary discussion and analysis, starring Sean Philip Cooper, Drew Keen, and Jack Tyler. Hello and welcome to Critical Readings, episode 101 for the 1st of November, 2021. I'm Dr. Cooper, and with me today I have just one panelist. It's Drew Keen.
Salutations.
Good afternoon, Drew. Now, our original plan this week was to go to the poetry of Thomas Wyatt, but we decided to make a slight detour, so it'll be Thomas Wyatt next week. And the reason for this is that in the preceding week, on the 27th of October, there's a very important and somewhat dark poetic birthday anniversary. For it is on 27 October that in 1914, the Welsh poet Dylan Thomas was born. And then, just a few years later, in 1932, the American poet Sylvia Plath was born. And of course, we're recording this, as we are, on the 30th of October, which is All Hallows Eve Eve. And this podcast is coming out on All Saints Day. And we thought it might be time to take a look at Sylvia Plath. Maybe next year we'll do Dylan Thomas. And they are, of course, related in a sort of strange way. Sylvia Plath was obsessed with the poetry of Dylan Thomas. And indeed, when she was a young woman at Smith College, she was an editor of the Smith Review. There's a plaque still on the wall there outside of her old room when she was there. And the editor of the magazine at Mademoiselle, where Plath was a guest, got a meeting with Dylan Thomas. Now, Plath loved Dylan Thomas. She was obsessed with his poetry. One of her boyfriends said that she loved him more than life itself, but she was not invited to the meeting that the editor of Mademoiselle scheduled with Dylan Thomas. She was just left out. It made her furious. So she wandered around the town, hoping to bump into him just by happenstance, well, constructed happenstance. She went to the White Horse Tavern, and she went to the Chelsea Hotel for 2 days, wandering around, just hoping to, you know, stumble into him. But he was already on his way home, so there was no chance of it. And it was shortly after that that she slashed her legs to see if she had the courage to kill herself. And later on, she made her first medically documented suicide attempt. And indeed, this would plague her for the rest of her life. She had a sort of compulsion towards suicide. She writes about it rather frankly in her poetry, but ultimately it was suicide that got her in the end when she gassed herself in her oven at the age of 30 while her two young children were in the room next door. She had two children by the poet Ted Hughes. One of them is a writer and artist, and the other, I am afraid to say, also suffered with a history of depression, and he hanged himself in 2009. Seems that there was something genetic about the way it was passed along, perhaps, and it's very sad. But I think that we'll see this in the poetry that we read today, that these are sort of demons, either real or metaphorical, with which she spent her entire life in combat, and eventually they defeated her. And it's very, very unfortunate. And you can see it in the poetry. It's very dark. And there's an intensity of despair that is presented in these poems that I've not seen in any other poetry. I've read lots of poetry about people who are suicidal and who would grapple with the idea of death. There's a long literary tradition of this. We might think perhaps most famously of Hamlet's soliloquy in Hamlet when he says to be or not to be. That is the question. He's contemplating suicide, but nothing quite as inescapably dark as Plath's poetry, which, while very difficult to read, maybe is instructive at the same time, that there is something demonic and horrible about it, but also that this may be the experience of those who are in the grip of depression, right? That there is a powerful, seemingly external force that's inescapable and horrific and kind of tentacular. Plath wrote of a depression that was like talons clutching at her heart. And I think we get the sense of that pain in the poems we're going to read today. And I've selected three for us. We will read them in full. They are not for the faint of heart. We will be reading Tulips, and then Lady Lazarus, and finally Daddy, which deal with also the deeply affecting experience when she was 8 or 9 years old, when her father died. He had had a friend who had lung cancer, and her father had diabetes, undiagnosed diabetes. And he thought that his symptoms were similar to those of his friend. And since lung cancer couldn't be treated, he didn't bother doing anything about it. He thought, well, it's hopeless, so I won't bother. Only later was it discovered he didn't have lung cancer at all. He had diabetes. They amputated his foot, but it was too late, and he died of diabetes, and it was probably preventable. Had he gone to the doctor sooner, they may have been able to save his life. This deeply affected Sylvia, right? That her father died because of this amputated foot, because he didn't get his diabetes reported sooner. And it may be one of the causes of her childhood depression, because it was after that that things became quite dark. And later on, she wrote of her childhood before her father's death as being a sort of extremely pleasant period, but sealed off from the rest of her life, she said, as if it were in a bottle. So that tells us that there's like a breach between the past and the present, right? She was treated extensively. It wasn't as if her depression went unnoticed. She was treated extensively for it. For the duration of her symptoms, with what was usual at the time, electroconvulsive therapy, that is to say, shock therapy. But it didn't work. It doesn't work. And we see the terrible.
And it's no longer practiced.
It's no longer practiced. Although we shouldn't probably judge them, you know, too harshly. That was what everyone believed at the time would work. And they were doing their best for her. But it doesn't work, and they couldn't help.
Long history of apparently nonsensical medical treatments that were at one time thought completely sensible.
And our own age is no stranger. In 100 years, right. They will look at the things we're doing today, and people will be agog.
Aghast.
Yeah. They will say, how could those fools of the early 21st century have done these horrible things to people to try to cure them of this or that? You know, we're all the fools of history in the end. We do what we can in the time we have. And I think it is at least cheering that they tried. People tried to help her with the limited knowledge they had. It's very sad they're unable to do so. All right. Well, let's get to it. It's worth saying Sylvia Plath was born in 1932. She died on February 11th, 1963, at the age of 30. And our first poem today is Tulips. And let's see. I don't want to give too much to Drew. I feel like I'm burdening him because I kind of threw this at him. These are tough.
Do you want me to read this?
Would you like to read this or Lady Lazarus?
Makes no difference to me, whichever one you say.
Well, let's give you Tulips to start with.
All right. The tulips are too excitable. It is winter here. Look how white everything is, how quiet, how snowed in. I am learning peacefulness, lying by myself quietly as the light lies on these white walls, this bed, these hands. I am nobody. I have nothing to do with explosions. I have given my name and my day clothes up to the nurses, and my history to the anesthetist, and my body to surgeons. They have propped my head between the pillow and the sheet cuff, like an eye between two white lids that will not shut. Stupid pupil. It has to take everything in. The nurses pass and pass. They are no trouble. They pass the way gulls pass inland in their white caps, doing things with their hands, one just the same as another. So it is impossible to tell how many there are. My body is a pebble to them. They tend it as water tends to the pebbles it must run over, smoothing them gently. They bring me numbness in their bright needles. They bring me sleep. Now I have lost myself. I am sick of baggage. My patent leather overnight case, like a black pill box. My husband and child smiling out of the family photo. Their smiles catch onto my skin like smiling hooks. I have let things slip. A 30-year-old cargo boat stubbornly hanging on to my name and address. They have swabbed me clear of my loving associations. Scarred and bare on the green plastic pillowed trolley, I watched my tea set, my bureaus of linen, my books sink out of sight. And the water went over my head. I am a nun now. I have never been so pure. I didn't want any flowers. I only wanted to lie with my hands turned up and be utterly empty. How free it is. You have no idea how free. The peacefulness is so big it dazes you. It asks nothing. A name tag, a few trinkets. It is what the dead close on, finally. I imagine them shutting their mouths on it, like a communion tablet. The tulips are too red. In the first place, they hurt me, even though the gift paper I could, even through the gift paper, I could hear them breathe lightly through their white swaddlings like an awful baby. Their redness talks to my wound. It corresponds. They are subtle. They seem to float, though they weigh me down, upsetting me with their sudden tongues and their color. A dozen red lead sinkers round my neck. Nobody watched me before. Now I am watched. The tulips turn to me, and the window behind me, where once a day the light slowly widens and slowly thins, and I see myself, flat, ridiculous, a cut paper shadow between the eyes of the sun and the eyes of the tulips. And I have no face. I have wanted to efface myself. The vivid tulips eat my oxygen. Before they came, the air was calm enough, coming and going, breath by breath, without any fuss. Then the tulips filled it up like a loud noise. Now the air snags and eddies round them the way a river snags and eddies round a sunken, rust-red engine. They concentrate my attention. That was happy playing and resting without committing itself. The walls also seem to be warming themselves. The tulips should be behind bars, like dangerous animals. They are opening like the mouth of some great African cat, and I am aware of my heart. It opens and closes its bowl of red blooms out of sheer love of me. The water I taste is warm and salt like the sea, and comes from a country far away as health.
Thank you for that, Drew. Well, in my book, I have some marks here from the last time I read this, which was 10 years ago, more than 10 years ago, in a graduate class with Clinton, our erstwhile podcasting companion. And one of the comments I've got here is with regard to stanza three. So we can back up to that real quickly. Stanza three, a reminder to our listeners. Reads, my body is a pebble to them. They tend it as water tends to the pebbles it must run over, smoothing them gently. They bring me numbness in their bright needles. They bring me sleep. Now I have lost myself. I am sick of baggage. My patent leather overnight case like a black pillbox. My husband and child smiling out of the family photo. Their smiles catch onto my skin, little smiling hooks. And I've underlined some words here. And the words I've underlined are run over, as in the pebbles it must run over. Numbness, needles, sleep, lost myself, baggage, night case, pillbox. And I have made a note here that these seem to be veiled references to suicide attempts. This is written in, let me see, I've got a date on here, March 1961. So this is just 2 years before she commits suicide, less than 2 years before she'll commit suicide successfully. And she tried many different ways of doing this. She tried taking pills. She tried slashing her wrists. She even tried crashing a car that she was driving. And so things like run over and needles and pillbox all strike me as, you know, these are the veiled references to the attempts that she has made, right? And then you think about if her body is a pebble, the metaphor that's used at the beginning, they tend it as water tends to the pebbles. It must run over, right? Well, what does that water do? It grinds them down. It wears them away until they become sand, right? Yes, there is smoothing, which is what's referenced here, smoothing them gently, but not just smoothing, eventual annihilation, right? Down to nothing. And what is the thing that restrains her? Well, that's where we get this. This is the baggage, right? The baggage, which is the overnight case and the husband and child smiling out of the family photo. This last line is signal to me. The smiles catch onto my skin, little smiling hooks, mm-hmm. right? These are the things that prevent or would prevent suicide, right? The things that that hook into her, hold her into life. And I think it's telling that she describes them as hooks that catch into her skin. That doesn't sound pleasant at all, right? The logical order of the living being who loves life and fears death in this stanza is completely inverted, right? That death is the longed for thing, right? The oblivion of being worn down and all these tools of death, right? The numbness, the needles, the pillbox, the being run over. These are seen as a gentle thing, right? Being smoothed gently into nothingness. And it's the things that make life attractive, the things that give us a reason to stay here, which are described like hooks in the skin, which hold you into the world, right? That you have to strain against them. The pain comes in like trying to pull away from the hooks.
Hooks are a kind of a fishing analogy. Yeah. So you can imagine her being the fish that's caught. For her, being alive feels like being a fish out of water.
Yeah.
She wants to be in the water. She doesn't want to be hooked and you know, hauled up out of the water, which is life in this analogy.
Yeah.
She
wants to be the pebble in the water, right? Just being washed over, just lying there and being slowly worn away into oblivion. Numbness. She wants numbness, nothingness, oblivion.
Well, and if your experience of life was such that you felt like a fish out of water all the time, you could imagine why numbness might be an attractive alternative.
Absolutely.
This poem also, according to Ted Hughes, who is the one who compiled together the collection Ariel, in which this was published posthumously, said that this was written while she was in hospital recovering from an appendectomy. Mm-hmm. So you can also get a sense of that, I think, from the poem. I mean, she talks about the experience of being gassed and put to sleep with the gas, and the days that she would have spent there recovering, where she's gotten used to the pattern of the sunlight that comes through the window, you know, just a little bit each day. And until the tulips came, the only eyes that ever passed over her were the nurses coming and going, like the water over the stones. But the tulips then are watching her, and that is deeply troubling to her, that she feels resentful of the presence of these tulips, which were designed to make her feel better. I mean, when you bring flowers to someone in hospital, it's to help them feel better, especially in an environment that's so, you know, almost, they don't mean it to be, but hospitals feel almost inhumane because they're so sterile and clean. And, you know, there's very little decoration and the little touches that make people feel at home. So when you bring flowers to someone, it's supposed to help them feel better. But this made her feel much worse, it seems.
Yes, right. Like from the very beginning, even their mere appearance is harmful. It's not dislike. It's harm. Tulips are too red in the first place. They hurt me. They hurt me. Even through the gift paper, I could hear them breathe in the next line. Then a stanza later, the final line, the vivid tulips eat my oxygen. And I think we start to see why this sentiment is. Like there's a sense in which she feels she cannot compare to the tulips, right? In that very same stanza, which is 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, in the seventh stanza in the middle, I see myself flat, ridiculous, a cut paper shadow between the eye of the sun and the eyes of the tulips, and I have no face. I have wanted to efface myself. There it is, that lust for annihilation, right? The idea of performing a sort of damnatio memoriae upon yourself, right? To blot yourself out as if you're an image that you could just chisel away from the existence, right? As if you had never been. And then the vivid tulips eat my oxygen. As she feels caught, like the sun has a purpose and the tulips have a purpose. And she's caught in between them. She doesn't belong. But yet, you know, she's resentful. The tulips are eating her oxygen. They're stealing. They're colorful. They're vivid. They have a purpose in the world. And the attention is given to them. The air is for them. And so there's a sense in which she feels like almost upstaged by the flowers.
Yes. Also, the comparison between the red of the flowers and the red of bleeding wounds.
Yes.
Interesting, I think. It makes the way in which she feels about the flowers or how the flowers are making her feel extremely vivid, I think. You know, they hurt her in the same way that a gaping cut would hurt.
It's astonishing. You said resentment. I think it's a really good word, right? The resentment towards these flowers. Before they came, the air was calm enough. Then the tulips filled it up like a loud noise. Again, their vividness, right?
Yeah.
They're vivid. I think vivid is a really good word. I'm glad she uses it, right? The vividness of the tulips, the vivid tulips. Well, vivid doesn't just mean bright, right? It's connected to the idea of life itself, right?
Yes.
Vitality. So it's not merely that these tulips are bright and loud insofar as they can be loud, but that they're vibrantly alive, even though they've been cut, right?
Mm-hmm.
They're cut and they've been taken out of their flower bed, and yet they're still vibrant in their life and their givingness, and they seem to have a purpose. And here she is. And by comparison, she feels bland and gray and unimpressive. And she's just lying there in the bed. And the tulips are what fill the room with color, not her. And the air snags and eddies round them the way a river snags and eddies round a sunken rust-red engine. Compare that to the way that pebbles are dealt with, right? The water flows over the pebbles. It smooths them down, but not the tulips. The river flows around them. It doesn't wear them down. It moves around them like a rust-red engine.
There's almost a sense in which you can catch some envy. The resentment might have some envy at its root, that their vivaciousness, their vitality almost mocks her lack of vitality.
Or their desire to strive, right? The tulips remain vivid and continue to turn to the sun, despite the fact they've been cut, right? There's an absolute unwillingness to succumb to death in the tulips. They're doomed.
Yes.
They are categorically doomed, but they're still bright and they're still red and they still turn towards the sun, and the sun still seems to be, you know, directed towards them. And it's as if the entire world is focused on the sun and the tulips, despite the fact that, you know, there's a fatalistic, inescapable death. It's as if the world is unwilling to accept this reality, right? As if the sun and the tulips are conspiring in a great lie that there's not, that they aren't dying, that they're alive and thriving. And this is deeply offensive to Plath and the speaker in this poem, who thinks it's a sham and it's a rejection of reality, right? The reality is death and oblivion and annihilation. And the fact that these flowers and the sun refuse to accept that reality, it's harmful in her estimation, to her at least, to her worldview, which rejects the value of rejecting that fatalistic attitude towards life itself.
The form of this poem, of course, it's a free poem, but it does almost have the feel of iambic pentameter. And T.S. Eliot says, insofar as there is such a thing as free verse, it works because it has echoes of form.
Yes.
And I think that's certainly present here. You can almost feel a line, even though there are no strict lines.
We've got stanzas of correct.
And we do have stanzas of equal length.
Yep. That imposes the sense of form.
Yeah. It's more on the page than it is in the ear, because you can't really hear the stanzas.
Yeah, there's a lot of enjambments in the lines, too. So
yeah.
It's deliberately designed to be kind of prosaic. But
I think one of the things that Plath is responsible for without knowing she would have been responsible for it, because she's a confessional poet in a time when this was rather new, and she's one of the three great confessional poets of contemporary American verse, Robert Lowell, Anne Sexton, and Sylvia Plath. But it has given rise to so much other confessional poetry, so much of which is bad. I mean, this is the kind of poem that, you know, the depressed high school student is going to try to emulate.
Yes.
And she does it so well and so effortlessly, apparently, that it's given rise to people saying, oh, this is easy and I can do that too. And producing a lot of really just dreadful,
terrible
poetry.
The worst, some of the worst ever written. I think that's the thing, right? And we're not trying to poop on high school students who have lots of many problems indeed, all of which seem world shattering, right? That's the nature of being a high school, to be an adolescent, right? Is to experience every emotional challenge as if it were the summit of an emotional experience, right?
Well, the waves of hormones that your body is flooded with don't help.
No, they don't, right? And they skew the way that you experience emotion. But Sylvia Plath, when she's writing this, she's not a high school student. She's 28. And so these are not the unconsidered juvenile misapprehensions of emotion, which are kind of catapulted into extremity by, you know, by hormones and a lack of experience. Rather, these are considered thoughtful, you know, lines that are written down with revision and thought while she's in hospital and has plenty of time to think about them, as Hughes points out. So we have to be very careful. What's going on here is not certain. It's not effortless, although it certainly right. appears that way. And it is not ill-considered or juvenile in any way. It's why the poets of her era, when they read this, they said immediately, this is, you know, this is the work of a supreme artist. And I think it's harder to actually see that now than it was at the time, because as you've pointed out, there's so much of this and so much of it is bad
right.
that we almost associate right. the form of it or the content with badness, when in fact that's not the case at all. It's just quite a lot of bad poetry of this sort.
It's also the fact that when this...
Oh, do go ahead.
When this poem was first published, it was inextricably tied to her death, because Ariel was published 2 years after her suicide, and she was already kind of beloved within the small circle of American poets. So when it was published, it was also, in their minds, tied to her suicide, and perhaps even some of them read it looking for answers about her suicide. So that's also, I think, part of how it has, it's a very heavily anthologized poem, and that's part of the reason why.
Indeed. It's interesting to note that when her work was published, very little of it was published in her lifetime. It was well received already. She won the Glasscock mm-hmm. Prize in 1955 for Two Lovers and a Beachcomber by the Real Sea. That she got that editor position at Mademoiselle. Which she won. She majored in English and she won all the major prizes in writing and scholarship at Smith. And when Heinemann published her first collection, which was in her lifetime, in 1960, she had already been shortlisted in the Yale Younger Poets. She had work printed in Harper's and in The Spectator and the Times New Literary Supplement, right? Wikipedia gets all of this stuff here. And then you read the reviews and the reviews are very positive. Let's see. The Colossus received reviews such as this. Punch called it a real find, exhilarating to read, full of clean, easy verse. The Manchester Guardian wrote, an outstanding technical accomplishment with a virtuoso quality. That's the one I was looking for, right? An outstanding technical accomplishment. So when you look at this free verse in Tulips, which is not part of the Colossus, right? This comes a little later. This is written by someone who has an absolute mastery of poetic technique. So I think it's worth keeping that in mind. And perhaps part of this is, you know, she studied with some really exceptional formal verse poets. She studied with Lowell. She knew W.S. Merlin personally. So she was soaking in a poetic environment that really did value formalism and understood it and knew from what it was deviating when it did so, right? That it was always a considered mm-hmm. approach. And I think mm-hmm. that there is often a mistake these days to now read Plath and kind of, I don't know, in a sort of semi-ironic way to kind of, you know, set her aside. Oh, that's just confessional poetry. Oh, it's just emoting, right? But it's not. It really isn't. And I think that...
Well, I think that...
Oh, please go ahead.
There's a misunderstanding, I think, about very emotional poetry that's partly the result of Wordsworth and Coleridge saying that poetry should be the spontaneous overflow of powerful emotion. Mm-hmm. And T.S. Eliot responded to that and said, no, it's an escape from emotion. And only those that really feel the need to escape from emotion would understand that. And certainly, I think that's the case for her. I mean, the fact that it is so confessional, I don't think was the spontaneous overflow of powerful feelings. It was a way to cope with feelings that were too overwhelming for her.
Absolutely. And I mean, we see them here, right? Again and again, this poem summons up the idea of being submerged, mm-hmm. right? In the third stanza, we talk about the, you know, the pebbles that the water runs over. But in the immediately following stanza, the water went over my head in the penultimate line. So the idea is continually to be submerged, to escape, as it were, from the difficult hooks of life that hold her here. and the desperate desire to just submerge and be numb, right? There's a numbness is what the desire is, which tells us that that life is unbearable if what you seek mm-hmm. is numbness. And she did have a difficult life. In the months leading up to her death, the pipes froze. She had no running water. She didn't have electricity. You know, it was really dire. So you can see that there were a lot of challenges. And she did not seem to be equipped to deal with them.
I'm glad you drew attention to the water imagery. And it shows up even in the last two lines. The water I taste is mm-hmm. warm and salt like the sea, and comes from a country far away as health. And so even the water that's brought to her in the hospital bed reminds her of the sea and of distant countries, which you brought up Hamlet as we were discussing suicide in verse. And that's part of that soliloquy,
mm-hmm.
the undiscovered country, which is always across the sea, of course. And mm-hmm. so I wonder if that is just the coincidence of you having brought it up, or if that was also something in the back of her mind as she wrote that line, which, in a poem that has so many, connections to suicide and that country far away. That does sound very similar, don't you think?
It does. It does. And that final line, right, seems to heighten the terror of the tulips to an existential yeah. threat. The walls also seem to be warming themselves. Are they warming themselves from the sun or from the tulips and their vividness? Mm-hmm. And then immediately following that line, the complete thought, the tulips should be behind bars like dangerous animal. They are opening like the mouth of some great African cat, and I am aware of my heart. They're consuming, ravenous tulips, more vivid than life itself, right? Present in the room. Too vivid, harmful. Well, we'll turn our attention to something even deeper and darker now. Our next poem is Lady Lazarus, which deals very frankly with her father, her heritage, and her suicide attempts, which is what this poem is primarily about. But it's worth noting that her father was a German Jew, and these are written after the Second World War, right, in the 1960s. Lady Lazarus is quite late indeed. I'm going to give you a date on it in just a second. It's just a few months before her death, I think.
Written four months before her death.
Yep. 23 to 29 October, 1962. So for us right now, that's exactly 40 years ago. Is that right? 80 years ago. 60 years ago. There we go. I'll get it eventually. I'm not a math major. 60 years ago, almost to the day, Sylvia Plath wrote this poem. It was not quite 20 years after the end of the Second World War. Here it is, Lady Lazarus. I have done it again. 1 year in every 10, I manage it. A sort of walking miracle, my skin, bright as a Nazi lampshade. My right foot, a paperweight. My face, a featureless, fine Jew linen. Peel off the napkin, oh my enemy. Do I terrify? The nose, the eye pits, the full set of teeth. The sour breath will vanish in a day. Soon, soon the flesh, the grave cave eight will be at home on me. And I, a smiling woman, I am only 30, and like the cat, I have 9 times to die. This is number 3. What a trash to annihilate each decade. What a million filaments. The peanut-crunching crowd shoves in to see them unwrap me hand and foot. The big striptease. Gentlemen, ladies, these are my hands, my knees. I may be skin and bone. Nevertheless, I am the same identical woman. The first time it happened, I was 10. It was an accident. The second time I meant to last it out and not come back at all. I rocked shut as a seashell. They had to call and call and pick the worms off me like sticky pearls. Dying is an art like everything else. I do it exceptionally well. I do it so it feels like hell. I do it so it feels real. I guess you could say I've a call. It's easy enough to do it in a cell. It's easy enough to do it and stay put. It's the theatrical comeback in broad day to the same place, the same face, the same brute, amused shout. A miracle that knocks me out. There is a charge for the eyeing of my scars. There is a charge for the hearing of my heart. it really goes. And there is a charge, a very large charge, for a word or a touch or a bit of blood or a piece of my hair or my clothes. So, Herr Doctor, so, Herr Enemy, I am your opus. I am your valuable, the pure gold, baby, that melts to a shriek. I turn and burn. Do not think I underestimate your great concern. Ash, ash, you poke and stir. Flesh, bone, there is nothing there. A cake of soap, a wedding ring, a gold filling. Herr God, Herr Lucifer, beware, beware. Out of the ash, I rise with my red hair, and I eat men like air. Mm. It's not the sort of thing that you read at a birthday party.
No, not hardly.
It's utterly chilling in some ways, and it deals with some of the great and horrific events of the 20th century, which are here partnered with the idea of suicide, right? The annihilation of the Jews by the Nazis, the gassing of them and the burning of their bodies and the sifting through the ashes for gold fillings and rings that they could melt down to fuel their engine of war, is also connected here to the desire to self-annihilate, which begins as an accident and then accelerates into a calling, right? You could say, I have a call. It's a terrifying poem in some ways because of the kind of unblinking frankness with which it so easily, it seems, discusses the desire to annihilate oneself. There's no sort of queasiness or regret or even really dancing around it. It's just cheerful, almost jocular, maybe not cheerful, but jocular in the way that it addresses this really terrifying, dark motivation.
Well, and it also builds momentum quite intentionally until the end, which is almost terrifying. Maybe that's a good segue into the discussion of form.
Yeah.
I think the form is part of how it builds momentum. It's in what looks on the page like tier sets. And you can almost hear that, I think.
Yes.
When it's read out loud. Which is a great technical achievement, but unlike, you know, a standard tier set, they're not rhyming or interlocking rhymes even, but there is almost an interlocking rhyme because she throws in rhymes, not with regularity, but frequently.
Yeah. Enough to string them together in places. Right.
Right. Exactly. And so it really does echo of that form in the way that really masterful free verse ought to do. So it's even though it's free, it's not free. I mean, it's very finely crafted. And as I said, it builds momentum towards the end. And we get, you know, we've had all of these Nazi analogies throughout the poem. And in the end, God and Lucifer are made into Nazis.
Yes.
Herr God, Herr Lucifer, beware, beware. But then thinking that might be, you know, sort of the end, that's as terrible as it gets, she becomes more terrible than either of those, God and Lucifer, conceived of as Nazis. She says, out of the ash, I rise with my red hair and I eat men like air. I mean, she's the threatening thing at the end, the speaker of the poem.
Well, I think that rising out of the ash, right, the sense of the phoenix, comes back to that idea of that, like the cat, I have nine times to die, right? The death and the rebirth, the fiery rebirth, right? Soon the flesh the grave cave ate will be at home on me. And I am a smiling woman. I am only 30. I love that line. And I am a smiling woman. I am only 30, right? We don't get the sense of these poems as being written by someone who can possibly smile, right? And yet, I think the smile is the smile of a death's head, right? It's the smile of a skull, right?
Yeah.
The sort of ironic smile at life, not the smile of contentment or the smile of happiness, but the, you know, the sort of sardonic death's head grin.
Yes, it's sinister.
Indeed, right? And especially once you know where this poem is going, that she's going to rise like a phoenix, right? With her red hair, which also symbolizes the flames, right? Like flames and fire, yes. And she will consume. I think that's important to remember too, because the Nazis, the hair god, hair Lucifer, what they're doing and what we're talking about at the end of the poem, ash, ash, you poke and stir, right? Or the worst, horrible, the horrible two preceding stanzas. I am your opus, I am your valuable, the pure gold baby that melts to a shriek. I turn and burn. It's like the sacrifices of Moloch, right? The baby that is sacrificed in the furnace for the benefit, for the perceived benefit of the population, like the Nazis, right? Sacrificing their Jews for the purity of the blood of the Aryan master race. There's a very similar sort of thing going on here. And, you know, she identifies with that. I am the pure gold baby. Yes, you know, they sacrifice her in the fire, but she rises out of the fire and consumes them in the fire, eating men like air. Because, of course, that's what fire does, right? It consumes oxygen.
Right. Just like those tulips were eating up her oxygen.
Indeed.
The right. Red tulips. Yeah, it's interesting. I think the speaker of this poem is both a victim of Nazis and also identifying with the Nazis, especially in treating death as an art form, all the different ways that you can kill people.
It's a tricky line, too, and it's hard to read on the page because it can seem like a boast if you're not careful with the punctuation, right? The line, the stanza is, dying is an art like everything else. I do it exceptionally well. And it's important to realize there are two separate sentences there. The first is dying is an art like everything else. And then the next sentence is I do it exceptionally well. It's not claiming that the speaker does everything exceptionally well. It's not like everything else I do it exceptionally well, but rather that dying is an art like everything else. Everything is an art. Dying is just another one of them. And she does that particular art, dying, exceptionally well. But spoken aloud, it suggests a pride, right? That you could you hover quickly over that full stop after else. Dying is an art. Like everything else, I do it exceptionally well. Yeah, the meaning shifts at once.
Well, and it has to be intentional. You wouldn't let something that was so easy to mishear stand in a final version of a poem unless you wanted both hearings to be there.
Absolutely, right? And we see the pride, the degree of satisfaction, right? I mean, yes, there's a desire to annihilate here. There's a recognition of the ultimate, you know, ending in nihilism, that soon the flesh the grave cave ate will be at home on me. Sure, right? Ultimately, you know, there will be nothing left. Her body will decay and dust and ash will be all that remains. But that doesn't stop her taking pride in a sort of vengeful desire for retaliation upon the Nazis, right? That she will arise out of the ash and she will consume men like air. And we see that here in this dying as an art, like everything else. I do it exceptionally well. I do it exceptionally well to be proud of the ability to die, but also like everything else, I do it exceptionally well. Encompassing, you know, sort of omnicompetence, if I may coin a word, right? The ability to do everything exceptionally well.
Well, it gets very close to the attitude of Milton Satan, I think, who, you know, saw himself as not inferior to God, and in fact thought of himself as just as good, if not better. He was exceptionally well at everything. And so that sort of pride, which gnaws away at him and results in death. And that's the same kind of spirit you can feel in this. Nihilism often has a kind of arrogance in it, you know.
Oh, absolutely. There's a theatricality to it.
Yeah.
As much as it sacrifices any hope for the future, it kind of has to build a bonfire in the present to glory in the moment, right? Otherwise, what's the point of anything? This is where the libertines go and Desaad, right? Who wants to be blasted into oblivion. He wants to be buried in a grave under a tree so that the tree will just destroy his casket and tear his body apart so that nothing will be left, right? He wants to be completely obliterated, but he doesn't live an understated life, the Marquis de Sade, right? Quite the opposite. it's to make a bonfire of the, you know, the everyday life, to burn it, to throw it under the fire and let it be consumed. And yes, the oblivion will come, but then at least in the moment, in the present day, you have this bright flash of light. And I think we see that here as well, right? The line itself is, it's the theatrical comeback in broad day. This is after that, dying is an art like everything else, right? I do it so it feels like hell. And I think we get this connection to an earlier line in the stanza when she's talking about the big striptease, gentlemen and ladies, these are my hands, my knees. But what follows that? Nevertheless, I am the same identical woman. So here's the sort of magical trick that's taking place, right? The idea that she's dead, but she comes back and she's the same, right? It's still my body, but I'm, you know, I was dead and I'm alive. Lady Lazarus, after all, being the title of this, right? Lazarus, you know, came to life. Jesus raised him from the dead, and he had the same body. He didn't come back as a different person. He was the same person. And so here we see it again, right? The theatrical comeback in broad day, the speaker says later on, to the same place, the same face, the same brute amused shout, a miracle that knocks me out. So the speaker desires this, right? There's a lusting for this theatricality, for the thrill of the crowd. But also there's a charge. Again and again, this line, right? There is a charge. There is a charge, a very large charge. And I don't know that it's just money, right? I think the charge here is spiritual, moral. That's something that even if these people who are seeing this and cheering it and hearing it and hoping for it and being thrilled by it, they're losing something. They have to give something up in order to do it. And the greater the engagement with her, the greater the charge. A very large charge for a word or a touch or a bit of blood or a piece of my hair or my clothes. And then she moves on to the Nazis. So, Herr Doktor. Mm-hmm. Right? The sense, I think here, maybe the sense that the Nazis, in as much as they thought they were achieving racial perfection or whatever it was that they were looking for, they were spending their humanity. There was a charge indeed, right? They became subhuman in their quest to achieve their Aryan perfection. They had to abandon their humanity entirely and become monstrous. A very large charge indeed.
And her also, with this nine lives, you know, every time that she attempts suicide, there's a charge.
There's a cost.
On her account, yeah. So to speak. And eventually, she will have overdrawn her account, and you can't come back anymore after that. It's almost like an inversion of Lazarus. You know, the story of Lazarus is, in many ways, one of the most beautiful affirmations of life. I mean, it's the story in which Jesus weeps because his friend died, even though, you know, Jesus knows what he's about to do to raise him from the dead, and knows about the general resurrection in a way that, you know, no one else present could, you know, in a kind of divine certainty. And yet he wept about death. And then he raises Lazarus in this affirmation that death is not the end. Life is the ultimate. And in the end of this, she rises up like the phoenix to eat men like air. So her rising back is not an affirmation of life. Her rising back is to seek out more death.
Indeed. Well, it's a terrifying poem in some ways.
It is. Really? It is, really.
It's revealing. And this revealing of a great darkness.
This tear set also is just absolutely terrifying. The ash, ash, you poke and stir, flesh, bone, there is nothing there. And you think of the soldiers who first saw Auschwitz and, you know, the remains, what they realized had happened there when they poked through the remains. And that's what that tear set is about.
Absolutely. So you can understand, I think, the vengefulness, right? The desire for revenge, the desire to rise out of the ash and eat men like air when this is, you know, what they have done. It's an unspeakable crime. Well, we have one.
And in
more.
A sense, the resentment makes you become like those that you resent.
Yes.
I mean, and that's what happens here too.
Right. Yeah. Well, indeed, it ends in a consumptive fire, which is exactly, you know, what we're.
A Holocaust.
Yeah. Precisely.
That's what the word means.
Yeah. That's exactly the thing that the desire for vengeance is aimed at. And of course, it causes it. Well, we have one more. If possible, this is darker still. I think it is because as much as I struggle with the idea of this vengeance, which I believe is just, but kind of misdirected or misunderstanding in its application. Daddy, which we're going to read next, is I don't know what it can do, right? In a way, it doesn't appear to have any sort of positive direction. But we're going to look at it anyway, and it is not even in my copy of the collected poems, believe it or not, but it isn't, which is astonishing to me. Nevertheless, I guess this collected poems is not complete.
Well, this is her most famous poem.
Yeah, it is. Edited by Ted Hughes, and he took this out.
Which was her husband.
That's right. Ex-husband.
Yeah.
It is not in here. I'm sure there's a story to that, but I mean, this even has uncollected juvenilia, but he leaves Daddy out. I'd love to know why that is. I don't have an answer for that, however. I'll have to look it up.
What year is your collected poems?
Oh, this is in the 80s, right? Let me see.
Because the source I'm looking at says this is from Collected Poems, copyright 1981 by Ted Hughes.
1981. Editorial material right. Yeah, copyright 1981 by Ted Hughes. Why isn't it in here? It isn't. Isn't that strange?
You have a defective copy.
Just missing one poem. It's missing Daddy for reasons nobody... Oh, no, wait, there it is. I found it. Why is it not in the index? It's not in the index.
Maybe it's a bad index.
It's not in the first... It's not in the index of first lines. It's not in the index of titles. But it is in here. Okay, I stand correct. It's on page 222. Perhaps it just didn't get indexed correctly. That happens. Writing an index is hard. I'll tell you that. It's very difficult.
Yeah.
Easy to mix stuff. All right. I'll give you this one too, Drew. Here's Daddy.
Oh, you're so generous.
I am so generous.
All right.
You do not do any more, black shoe, in which I have lived like a foot for 30 years, poor and white, barely daring to breathe or a chew. Daddy, I have had to kill you. You died before I had time. Marble heavy, a bag full of God. Ghastly statue with one gray toe, big as a Frisco seal, and a head in the freakish Atlantic, where it pours bean green over blue in the waters off beautiful Nauset. I used to pray to recover you. Ach, du. In the German tongue, in the Polish town, scraped flat by the roller of wars, wars, wars. But the name of the town is common, my Polack friend, says there are a dozen or two. So I never could tell where you put your foot, your root. I never could talk to you. The tongue stuck in my jaw. It stuck in a barbed wire snare. Eek, 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 eek. I could hardly speak. I thought every German was you, and the language obscene. An engine, chuffing me off like a Jew to Dachau, Auschwitz, Belsen. I began to talk like a Jew. I think I may well be a Jew. The snows of the Tyrol, the clear beer of Vienna, are not very pure or true. With my gypsy ancestress and my weird luck, and my Tarok pack, I may be a bit of a Jew. I have always been scared of you. With your Luftwaffe, your gobbledygoo, and your neat mustache, and your Aryan eye, bright blue, Panzermann, Panzermann, oh you, not God, but a swastika, so black no sky could squeak through. Every woman adores a fascist. The boot in the face, the brute, brute heart of a brute like you. You stand at the blackboard, Daddy, in the picture I have of you. A cleft in your chin instead of your foot. But no less a devil for that, no, not any less the black man who bit my pretty red heart in two. I was 10 when they buried you. At 20... I tried to die and get back, back, back to you. I thought even the bones would do, but they pulled me out of the sack, and they stuck me together with glue. And then I knew what to do. I made a model of you, a man in black with a Mein Kampf look and a love of the rack and the screw. And I said, I do, I do. So, Daddy, I'm finally through. The black telephone's off at the root. The voices just can't worm through. If I've killed one man, I've killed two. The vampire who said he was you and drank my blood for a year. 7 years, if you want to know. Daddy, you can lie back now. There's a stake in your fat black heart, and the villagers never liked you. They are dancing and stamping on you. They always knew it was you. Daddy, Daddy, "You bastard, I'm through." This dates to 12 October 1962, so written at about the same time as Lady Lazarus, a couple weeks before, and just four months before she committed suicide. And I think this goes back to what we were talking about when we first talked about Sylvia Plath and her childhood and the death of her father and how that kind of was a gulf, right? It sealed off her childhood from her. You really get that sense in this poem that the death of her father and her relationship with him up until that point, it just permanently changed her, and she was never able to really escape from it. Here she even, you know, says that her first attempt to commit suicide really was an attempt to rejoin her father, right? Her dead father, who died as a result of this foot amputation. Mm-hmm. But we don't get the sense here that her father was some sort of loving individual. In fact, he's connected to the Nazis over and over and over again, right? The model of him is the model of a Mein Kampf look, right? Every woman desires a fascist, his German tongue in the Polish town, the swastika, the Aryan eye, the Luftwaffe. She paints an image of her father as a Nazi, and she's in love with him. I think her first poem, one of the first poems she had published was about her father's death. And then I think it's something to do with Elektra, right? There's a sort of Elektra complex going on here, perhaps. If I may employ a bit of Freudian terminology, debunked though it may be, she and other people of her generation certainly believed in it.
Well, I mean, it's certainly, even though the Elektra theory of Freud is overstated in some ways, it is verifiable that the image of masculinity that women grow up with tends to be in some way tethered to their early perceptions of their fathers. Mm. And men tend to marry women who in some ways resemble their mothers, and women tend to marry men who in some ways resemble their fathers. All kinds of exceptions, of course, but there's a statistical tendency in that direction.
The poem she wrote when she visited her father's grave was called Elektra on Azalea Path. So even she is certainly aware of and drawing on this notion. It's not subconscious. She's fully aware of it. And here I think we definitely see it, right? This poem is to a large degree about her navigating her love for her father. I think that we get this idea, Ted Hughes shows up in this poem, and it's not a pleasant, right? Sylvia Plath's letters, it's difficult to substantiate this because she died, right? But her letters allege a degree of abuse at the hand of Ted Hughes. And the poem, both in Lady Lazarus and in Daddy, reference this brutishness, right, on the part of the men in her life. And she says here, if I've killed one man, I've killed two. Well, one perhaps is her father. It's misplaced sense, right, that she's killed him. But the other is the vampire who said he was you and drank my blood for a year, 7 years, if you want to know. That's the length of her relationship with Ted Hughes. A vampire, right? A living off of her. We think back to the way that her blood is discussed in Tulips, right? It's that sort of, it's connected to the idea of that warm salt water that she drinks. Here is Hughes, right, who's drinking her blood, the vampire who claimed to be her father.
Well, and if you, to be unfair to him, and I don't know if this is fair or not, really, but the fact that he, you know, then publishes her collected works after her death and profits from that, I mean, he's in that sense, still drinking her blood.
Absolutely. I think you're right that to say that is a trifle unfair, because if he didn't publish her works, then we'd be justly furious, right? I mean, I think that what we can say is that he didn't go into this poem and cut any of that out, right? It's unedited. He could have, he could have, you know, cheated history by tweaking his representation of her, as it could have been done with her letters, which he allowed to be published unedited, in as much as they depict him unfavorably. But this isn't a podcast about Hughes. I just think it's particularly interesting here that we have this this depiction of her father, which is so negative, it seems, right, at first look. So extraordinarily negative.
It is about her father, of course, and her relationship with her father, but it's also about, she said that her father is all Germans. She thinks of her father as all Germans, and she identifies herself.
I thought every German was you. Yeah.
Right. And she identifies herself as a Jew vis-a-vis her father, the Uber German, so to speak, and the embodiment of all German. She's associated them, of course, with Nazis. And then she describes him as, Daddy, I have killed you. You died before I had time. Marble heavy, a bag full of God. And so not only is he all Germans, he's also her image of God. And of course, that also is psychologically natural to have your earliest images of God shaped by your relationship with your parents and especially your father. And so in a sense, this is her also embodying what much of the 20th century does after World War II, which is coming to terms with what is the world after the Holocaust? What is the world after that? What do things mean? Where do we stand? And who is God? And how do we come to terms with the idea of God in the aftermath of that? And so her memory being haunted by her father, in a sense, is like the time in which she lived being haunted by World War II.
Her father, I get this from Wikipedia, where they have that picture, the picture that Sylvia had of him in front of the blackboard, smiling with the cleft in his chin. He was a biologist, and he was a professor of biology and German at Boston University. And he had a specific expertise on honeybees. And then Wikipedia tells us he's notable for being the subject of one of his daughter's most well-known poems, Daddy. So it's clear, I think, that the death of Otto Plath is extraordinarily traumatic. So much so that she never escapes from it, right? She tries, and I think that's what we see in that second stanza. I have had to kill you, right? That there's a sense in which she has to kill her father or her memories of her father or demonize him in her mind to get away from him. And it's difficult, I think, for her to separate him from the idea of the Nazis then, right? Because living in America, she probably doesn't run into too many Germans, but her father was German, right? And there's a sense in which the idea of Germanness becomes the idea of her father. I think every German was you, she says, and the language obscene. And then she thinks of all the things that the Germans did, and they become a way of killing her father, right? If you can darken his memory by heaping the crimes of the Nazis on her father as well, sort of like a representative sacrifice, right? Then it becomes easier to move beyond him, almost like as a coping mechanism, right? If you can demonize him enough, then you can cease idolatrizing him.
Well, she doesn't.
Yeah, I think that's the thing, that it doesn't work until the very end of the poem, when it seems to suggest she's achieved her goal, right? That I'm through of the final line. There's a stake in your fat black heart. Finally, he's dead. Right. Finally. And I think that connects that previous line, right? The vampire who said he was you. Well, then the question is that final line actually about her daddy, or is it about the vampire? Is it about Hughes? Right. Is this the final break with Hughes? And the speaker has allowed herself to become confused. Is she speaking about her daddy anymore? Or is she speaking about the surrogate?
Both. And about God.
Yeah.
All three lumped together. And, you know, when you think about an ugly divorce. There's a sense in which once it's over, you want it to be fully over, that you've pounded a stake into the heart of the brute. But in a sense, a divorce is never really over. I mean, there's the haunting of it. You still have to deal with that person forever. There's no hard break permanently, finally. So there's this lingering difficulty. Same with her memory of her father. You can't get rid of it. Can't get away from it. It's interesting that she makes him both God and the devil. She calls him what looks like his dead body is like a bag full of God. But then she says the cleft in his chin instead of a cleft in his foot. And so there she's comparing him to, you know, the cloven foot image of the devil. And in the previous poem we read, we saw German God and German Lucifer. Hair God, hair Lucifer. And so she equates the two of them in much the way that, you know, people after the Second World War had to come to terms with, you know, God and the suffering that was, permitted. And so, you know, for many people, that was more than their faith could bear. It appeared more demonic than divine. And so, not real atheism in the sense of not believing, but a kind of resentment that would want to be atheist.
Yes.
And that resentment is here in this poem, this and the other two poems as well, but more pronounced here than in anything else is this just consuming resentment.
Well, it's got a very clear, concrete focus here, right?
Yeah.
Whereas even in Lady Lazarus, the Herr Doctor, Herr Lucifer, Herr God are all abstract. Right. Even Lucifer, who's given a name and we can think of him, but even he's kind of an abstract, function of the poem. He doesn't really participate. He doesn't really get described. He's just there. Here, however, we have a real, very clear, descriptive, concrete image of her father who could possibly be closer. So it's really, I think the resentment here is extraordinarily powerful. Wikipedia tells me that I don't know of this. I haven't read Plath's letters, but that Plath alleged that her father was a Nazi sympathizer. And remember, he died when she was 8. And the FBI conducted an investigation into him, as they did with many German Americans, for no reason
other than
the fact they were of German heritage. And they found no evidence of this. Her father was a pacifist. So the scholar Heather Clark has said that either Sylvia was misremembering, perhaps, or perhaps there's anger and resentment.
Well, do you think that that lampshade, the Nazi lamp that she references in an earlier poem, is a memory of something that she saw, or is just something that she's made up?
Well, it would have been impossible for her to have seen it, right, in their household. So I would imagine that this is something that she's read or heard, and has kind of like imagined herself as a Jew, right, being made into this or having this done to her. And it becomes in Lady Lazarus, I think, one of the images of the Holocaust and the horror. That is also a unique metaphor for the way in which, that somehow she can live again and light can come forth, right? It shines through her, she says in that poem, right? Shines through her skin. Because that's what's going to happen. She's going to burst forth in light at the end of the poem and fire, consuming fire. So I think it's a very affecting and terrible metaphor at the same time, as it also serves, a historical reference. Here in this poem, we don't have that as much as the actions of her father, particularly his physical appearance, which I wonder about a lot, right? Possibly because the Nazis were so fixated on physical appearance, right? Aryan appearance, right? Cleft chin, blue eye, blonde hair. And this is well known. There was nothing secret about that at all. It was what they were clearly trying to accomplish. And so I think that we see this fixation here on physical appearance as a kind of way of condemning her father for the sins of all Germans, right?
Or rather the sins of the Nazis, not all Germans.
Although well, she said, I thought every German was Nazis. You. And I wonder, to what degree does she lump them all in together, right? Her father wasn't
a Nazi.
I think
she sees German as Nazi.
Yeah, exactly, right? That they're equated in her mind.
Right. Even the language to her sounds like it's, devilish in a sense.
Obscene. Yeah. And what does it bring to mind? The idea of, being chuffed off like a Jew, which works, it has a double operation, right? The chuffing of the engine that carries the Jews to Dachau, Auschwitz, Bergen-Belsen, and so on, which she mentions, but also the sense of like the smoke chuffing from the furnaces in which the corpses of the murdered Jews were burned, and the being chuffed off, right? Like burnt away into smoke and ash, which takes us back to Lady Lazarus. Or for her, would take her forward because she would write that after this. So there's a heaping of these infamies on her father.
I think in a real formal way, you could say this whole poem is a confrontation between the you, her father, and the Jew, herself conceived as a Jew. Because the rhyme that keeps popping up everywhere is between you and Jew.
Yes.
I mean, and that rhyme is overused to the point that it's intentional. I mean, you get do and chew and a chew, but more than anything else, you and Jew are the rhyme words.
Yes, right.
So I think she sees it as a confrontation between those.
Absolutely. There's a, especially at the end, when that you rhyme becomes just so continuous.
Yeah.
Do, through, to, you. You. Three lines in the final stanza end in you. And there's a you in the final line and a your in the first line. So you shows up in four of the five lines and you're in the first line. So really accusative at that point, right? You. Before that terminal,
yes,
I'm
point.
Through, right?
Pointing the finger.
Exactly.
Definitely.
Well,
if you're looking for any sign of redemption in this poem, it's not there. So.
Yeah, wouldn't it be nice if we could find some neat way to resolve this and to say that this, you know, this rising action, as it were, can neatly resolve and bring harmony, but it doesn't end in harmony. It just ends like a rising shriek, kind of very similar to Lady Lazarus, right? Which is like a rising shriek ending with a bursting forth in a consumptive fire. Here we have the rising shriek, right? Louder and louder, angrier and angrier, right? And still it just stops. It doesn't end. It stops.
Yeah.
Sylvia Plath. Those are difficult poems. They're difficult to discuss. They deal with things that are very, very hard for people to accept and that are part of the human condition and the human story now. And as much as we don't want to glorify violence or suicide, we also look at Sylvia Plath and have to say that this, you know, is one way that the human mind deals with these terrible, traumatic events. It's why so many...
Yes, it's...
So many Jews who survived the Holocaust committed suicide. They just couldn't bear it, couldn't process it, couldn't handle a world where this could happen. And something similar has happened here.
Yes, and it's ironic in a very, very sad way that in coming to terms with all of that violence, it is violent poetry that is her mechanism. And whether or not that was, I mean, obviously she's given us brilliant verse that's now a part of our tradition permanently, but it's violent verse, and it's a response to violence, attempt to come to terms with violence, but the resentment in it is also itself consuming and violent.
It doesn't resolve, right? I think that's the lesson, if we have to draw a lesson here, is that Plath's inability to resolve these things with this kind of resentment or desire for vengeance or desire for annihilation or a desire for oblivion. These don't work. They didn't work. They consumed her and she's gone. So there has to be a better way. But I can't tell you what it is. It's not here though. And I think that's something that these poems themselves admit, right? That they don't contain in them any sort of sense of resolution. You don't get the sense, even at the end of Daddy, when there's a stake in his fat black heart and the speaker is through, you don't get the sense that that's real, right? That you can truly believe the speaker, especially because, you know, 2 weeks later, she wrote Lady Lazarus and her, you know, her father is there in a sense, still hovering, right? Well, next week, something where we may find some resolution, because next week we'll be looking at Thomas Wyatt, and Thomas Wyatt is about as far removed from Sylvia Plath as it is possible to be. Although he dealt with some
hardship himself.
Yeah, hardship as well. And also with unfair political circumstances that threatened his life, right?
Also died in his 30s.
He did.
39.
That's quite right. So there you go. I was thinking about Circa Regna Tonat, right? When Thomas Wyatt writes that he had been a lover or wanted to be a lover, it's unclear, of Anne Boleyn. And then Henry VIII decided he would prefer to enter that competition. And he knew at that point that you don't get involved. And so he wrote a poem about the chase for a heart, right? As pursuing a heart. And,
yes, who so lists to hunt.
Indeed, exactly. And so, of course, once the prince gets involved, you stand aside. You don't want to be the one.
Nolle me tangere.
Indeed, touch me not. For Henry's I am. But later on, he would see what happened to Anne Boleyn and what transpired. He then wrote while he's imprisoned, for he had been, of course, suspected of having been her lover. And that was the charge that was leveled against her. He would see what sort of insanity and madness kind of moved around that political circumstance. So that's all to come next week. So in as much as it's very different, this love poetry, it is not removed from darkness and strife. They are part of the human condition, and we have to learn how to address them, frankly.
One of my professors in undergrad was fond of saying, we only write about death and love. There's nothing else.
Yes, right? No, I think there's an essential truth to that. It's something that Inspector Morse says in one of the last episodes before he dies. He's talking to his faithful lieutenant and who couldn't quite understand opera, Lewis. Mm-hmm. And he was listening to Wagner. It was Morse's great love, and Lewis couldn't understand it. And rather angrily, as at this point it had been many years, Morse tells him, you know, it's about life and death and love, important things, right? And yeah. Those really are the important things, death and love. Those are the important things.
Yeah.
And of course, eventually Lewis came to appreciate opera. He became a big opera fan in his own series. So it worked. Maybe it'll work for you. Death and love, the important things. That's why Wagner for Morse. It's why Wagner for me too. Death and love. Next week, we'll have both. Death and love with Thomas Wyatt. All that remains for this week is for me to thank my panelist, and it was Drew Keene. Thank you ever so much, Drew.
Thank you.
But also to thank, we have a new supporter. So thanks ever so much to Lisa for your very generous contribution. And that's why your name is in the credits. And we'll do that for you as well. All you need to do is go to criticalreadings.com and click that Become a Patron button. And you can sign up for a very small donation every month. Or if you're feeling generous, a particularly large donation every month. And that will help us to pay our hosting costs, which come to about $350 a year. So if just a few people, five or six people, were to donate $5 a month, that would cover all of our costs. If you don't have the money, fear not. We will never, ever gate any part of our content behind a paywall. It will always be free for everyone forever. So if you have the money and you feel motivated to help us, feel free to do so. And if you don't have it, then listen without guilt. We will make sure to provide every episode to you, and they'll always be available on our website. Thank you ever so much to all of our patrons. We'll be back next week with the poetry of Thomas Wyatt. Until then, from all of us here at Critical Readings, Godspeed. You've been listening to Critical Readings, with special thanks to our supporters, Turnus, Alessandro, and Lisa. Copyright Sean Philip Cooper. All rights reserved.